Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here with so many friends and colleagues in the service of institutions that matter. It's also a special privilege to have been introduced by George W. Bush. I appreciate that. In the spirit of President Bush, I suppose we should be uniters and not dividers. We'll hear a little bit more about that as we talk about fusionism later today. What I want to talk about today is Adam Smith's theory of freedom. Adam Smith did not offer a theory of metaphysical freedom, and I think that's largely because he had a general aversion to metaphysics. Many of his claims had metaphysical suppositions, but he was probably even more anti-metaphysical than his good friend David Hume, if that's possible. But that doesn't mean he had no theory of political freedom. We can construct his theory of freedom by working backwards from some of the specific claims he makes about human action and from some of his specific policy recommendations. So what I'd like to do today is to sketch his conception of freedom and then connect it to the political economic tradition of liberalism. So I'll begin where Smith did with his first book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, which Phil said he thought was Smith's finest. Smith claims in The Theory of Moral Sentiments that one of the four central virtues is what he calls self-command. Now, he claims that, indeed, that self-command is what gives the other three central virtues. For him, that's prudence, justice, and proper beneficence. Self-command is what gives them their principal luster, as he says. But what exactly constitutes the virtue of self-command? Well, it seems to require, first of all, that one has an ability to separate oneself, both from one's own passions and from the influences of others around one, and then to direct one's judgments and actions with both deliberation and conscious intentionality. So Immanuel Kant, who was a reader and admirer of Adam Smith, would come to call this rational autonomy. Now, Smith had argued that what he called the desire for mutual sympathy of sentiments is one of our strongest social desires. Indeed, it's the desire that gives rise to our shared moral sentiments. It's when we discover that others enter into or sympathize, in his terms, with our own sentiments that we experience the pleasure of mutual sympathy. Because successfully achieving the sympathy of sentiments is pleasurable to us, this gives us incentive to judge or behave in ways that generate this mutual sympathy. Similarly, when we realize that others do not enter into or sympathize with our sentiments, we experience a displeasure, and that arises from what Smith called an antipathy of sentiments, which encourages us to revise our judgments or behaviors. The result of this is a mutual drive toward shared expectations about one another's behavior, a process that over time gives rise to a shared set of standards about morality, manners, and etiquette. Thus, self-command is a virtue for Smith because it enables us to constrain our judgments and our behaviors so that they accord with not what we might like, but with what others expect of us, and with what comes to constitute praiseworthy behavior. Now, there's a little bit more of a complicated story that I'll elide for the purposes of time that involves the generation of a perspective Smith calls that of the impartial spectator. Maybe during question and answer we can talk a little bit about that. But for Smith, self-command thus enables us to direct our actions so that they accord with virtue. But there does seem to be a tension here, because Smith believes we can't rid ourselves from this desire for mutual sympathy of sentiments. This is hardwired into us, according to him. Now, this may seem like a liability, but it's actually a crucial part of Smith's account of human social orders, and thus a key to understanding Smithian political economy. One reason that Smith is optimistic about the development of relatively beneficial decentralized social orders, that is, orders not administrated or designed by centralized authorities, is because he believes we all feel the pull of this desire for mutual sympathy of sentiments. So he might fruitfully explain and understand Smith's theory, then, as libertarian paternalism, to coin a phrase. So let me explain why. The self-command Smith extols comprises two main things. The first is this strong and natural pull toward compliance with others' expectations. It's a kind of centripetal force that drives us into society with others. This is a good thing. Unless you are a sociopath or maybe an economist, you don't want to alienate everyone around you. Indeed, on Smith's account, that would be a virtual recipe for unhappiness. Because a chief component of happiness is loving relationships with others, each of us has to figure out how to establish and maintain such relationships. That means we'll have to moderate our behavior so that it falls within what others find to be acceptable parameters. Consider, just as an example, the rules regulating the telling and laughing at jokes, which is one of Smith's favorite examples. I'll give you one quote from Smith. Smith says, "A man is mortified when, after having endeavored to divert the company with a joke, he looks around and sees that nobody laughs at his jests but himself." It's very awkward. Having been to many Philadelphia Society meetings, I've seen that firsthand. So this gives us reason not only to seek out companionship with others, but also to coordinate our behaviors, our beliefs, even our tastes, with those others who matter to us. Their expectations then become nudges for us, and as naturally social creatures, we thus face a naturally hypothetical imperative. If I want to be happy, I need to try to accommodate myself to others' expectations. And now when parents give children guidelines and corrections for behavior, these paternalistic nudges are aimed at helping them comply with what parents know will be others' expectations of their children. Now, parents also understand, at least at some level, I think, that their children's relative ability to figure out and even anticipate what others will expect of them will be a crucial skill that is necessary, of course not sufficient, but necessary for successful relations with others, and ultimately one key ingredient for happiness. So the good parent seeks to give his children a leg up on successful social relations by helping them anticipate the behaviors that are likely to achieve mutual sympathy of sentiments with others, as well as, and perhaps even more important, guidelines that can help avoid behaviors likely to achieve an antipathy of sentiments. Now, what constitutes the appropriate accommodations that any of us should make to others' expectations can fall only within reasonable and acceptable parameters. Crucially for Smith, we always retain the ability, and in some cases even the duty, to depart from others' expectations. This is the second part of Smith's conception of self-command. The desire for mutual sympathy of sentiments means that the default is to comport with others' expectations, and our ability to exercise self-command determines our relative ability to do so, yet we can also choose when not to comply. This is Smith's psychological, moral, and ultimately political libertarianism. Now, knowing when not to comply, when to comply and when to defect is not easy. It's a function of good judgment, which Smith, following Aristotle, believes is a skill that must be practiced to be effective. But practice alone is not enough. We must also have feedback, and this feedback must actually have some purchase on us. That's precisely the role that the desire for mutual sympathy of sentiments plays. When others do not enter into our sentiments, it generates a displeasure in us. We cannot escape that, according to Smith. But what we can do is select those opportune moments when the displeasure is worth it. When, for example, some other good, maybe compliance with what Smith calls the impartial spectator, outweighs the cost of failing to achieve mutual sympathy of sentiments in a particular case. Every morally mature person of good judgment deliberately distances himself from potential instances of mutual sympathy of sentiments at various times in his life. It's often difficult to know when we should do so, and we often get it wrong. That's part of being an imperfect human being. But we possess the ability to choose to depart from others' expectations, and virtue will require, according to Smith, that we do so in many circumstances throughout our lives. Hence, the picture of human freedom that emerges for Smith is one of, as I said, libertarian paternalism, both on the individual level as well as, therefore, on the political level. So on the individual level, others' expectations of us are their nudges, and their overt recommendation, and the overt recommendations we make to people to follow those expectations are part of the paternalistic aspect of human sociality. Our default to following those nudges is thus a proper response to that paternalistic impulse. Yet those occasions when we demur are instances of our freedom to follow different paths. So according to Smith, the set of default principles that we should follow are derived from induction on the basis of past experience with people's expectations. The rules we develop, these are the rules of morality, of etiquette, etc. These rules we develop inductively are recommended to us paternalistically as conducive to happiness. On the other hand, virtue also requires, as I said, requires us to depart from those recommendations in the appropriate circumstances. The facts that A, we can do so, and B, that we exercise our self-command when we do so appropriately, are indicative of our moral freedom. This is the libertarian aspect of Smith's conception of human moral agency. But Smith's libertarian paternalism, as I call it, applies at the level of political policy as well. Smith's survey of historical and empirical evidence leads him to conclude in The Wealth of Nations that those societies that allow labor to divide and people to enjoy the rewards or suffer the defeats, as the case may be, of their activities are the ones in which prosperity increases. He argues that government should do only a few things: enforce what he calls justice, which for him just means protecting people's persons, property, and promises, the important three P's, and protecting them both against foreign and domestic aggression. And then in addition, providing those few public works that he says provide benefit to the nation as a whole and cannot be provided by private enterprise. Now, I'll just note that it turns out that that category of public works is pretty small. If you ask yourself how many things, goods or services, both would benefit the entire nation as a whole, not one group at the expense of another, and also could not be provided by private enterprise, that's perhaps not a very large set of things. Smith speculates that it might involve only a few things, like infrastructure that facilitates commerce, also potentially partially subsidized, locally controlled primary schooling. But what about all those other things that are required for a fully virtuous life? Now, just note that Smith, in Book 5 of The Wealth of Nations — this is the part of The Wealth of Nations that Ronald Coase said you shouldn't actually read because Smith probably went insane by the time he got to the end. So in Book 5, Smith says, worries about the deleterious effects that extreme division of labor can have on laborers. He said, I'll quote Smith, he said, it could render them as stupid and ignorant as it is possible for a human creature to become, not mincing words. Smith suggests as a potential remedy, requiring every student, every citizen to learn to read, write, and do basic arithmetic and geometry. But in The Theory of Moral Sentiments, Smith speaks at length about the various aspects of what he calls beneficence. These are positive actions that one should take on others' behalf, beneficence, that are required to be fully virtuous. So if the state is discharged from the responsibility for beneficent matters, how can we be sure that people will be able to develop into virtuous creatures? The Smithian answer is the libertarian paternalism that underlies his conception of the moral marketplace. The state is relieved of superintending the beneficent actions in which people should engage, not only because it's incompetent to do so — so dependent is proper beneficence on the local details of particular situations that such matters can't be determined in the abstract or from afar — but also because people's natural desire for mutual sympathy of sentiments will already do the job as well as can be hoped. So the patterns of localized moral judgment become then like prices. They convey information about people's expectations, their tolerances, their willingness to go along with novelty, and so on. And these prices, these moral prices, as it were, are responsive to people's actual particular circumstances and exploit their local knowledge. And they do so in a way that no centralized authority, however expert, could possibly hope to do. So Smith's policy recommendations for a limited government cohere with his view about the development of moral sentiments and the dynamism that is inherent in human sociality and human life. The result is an integrated theory of human freedom that incorporates both his moral theory and his policy recommendations. Now, if you'll allow me — do I have a couple more minutes? If you'll allow me, let me just contrast very briefly Smith's position of what I'm calling libertarian paternalism from the libertarian paternalism of more recent vintage, namely that of Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein in their 2009 book, Nudge. You may recall that Sunstein was appointed by President Obama to be the first regulation czar. So in both cases, both of Smith on the one hand and Thaler and Sunstein on the other, we have recommendations about what behaviors to engage in or to avoid based on a kind of hypothetical imperative that I described earlier. For Smith, it's an imperative to have a happy life, while for Thaler and Sunstein, it's more like having a healthy and, I mean, I would add also a relatively docile life. The central difference, however, is that on Smith's account, these recommendations arise decentrally from the experiences and expectations of people's actual lives and interactions, while on Thaler and Sunstein's account, the recommendations arise from centralized experts like, well, Thaler and Sunstein. But like the social planner attempting to set prices or allocate resources centrally, Thaler and Sunstein are not in a position that would allow them to exploit people's localized knowledge of the salient details about their lives. This includes their opportunities, their schedules of values, their resources, their hierarchies of purpose. And so their recommendations, again, like those of the Central Economic Planner, will inevitably fail to comport with what would actually conduce to people's well-being. Thaler and Sunstein's libertarian paternalism becomes then the imposition of restrictions and costs in order to gain people's compliance not with what would be in their own best interests, but rather with Thaler and Sunstein's wishes. Smith, by contrast, argues that it's a fallacy to fancy oneself able to direct others in the pursuit of their ends and in the proper allocations of their time, talent, and treasure. The man of system, according to Smith, overestimates his knowledge of other situations and thus overestimates his ability to actually benefit others of whom he knows little or nothing. Smith is impressed by the limits of any given individual human being's knowledge, even while he recognizes and appreciates the ability of locally conditioned moral sentiments to be responsive to and coordinate the activities of indefinitely many people. So Smithian libertarian paternalism is able not only to exploit local knowledge and to respond to people's actual lived experience, but it also has the considerable benefit of allowing no single person or group of persons to claim the authority to direct others' lives on the basis of a false pretense of knowledge. Smith's theory of freedom, therefore, not only incorporates a robust notion of political and economic community, but it also gives us strong incentives to associate ourselves peaceably, cooperatively, and productively with others. Thus, it allows the generation and application of robust moral communities, complete with full moral agents who retain the ability always to say no. So let me conclude then by asking how we should categorize Smith politically. Those of you who have been reading the secondary literature on Adam Smith will know that in the last 30 years or so, there's something of a sea change in opinion about Adam Smith. For some two centuries, he was taken to be the founding father of what we now call capitalism, of free markets, and liberal order. Many commentators today want to claim him for the progressive left, thinking that his concerns for things like the poor mean that he must be on the left, because we know only people on the left care about the poor. So how should we categorize Smith? I regard Smith's single most important contribution to social science to be his suggestion that complicated and successful systems of social order can arise without any overall designer. That's Smith's innovation, not Hayek's, not Darwin's, both of whom got it from Smith. Now, he thought that this explained the development of moral sentiments, of the means of economic production and exchange, and even of language. His discovery, moreover, of the implications of the fact that humans have only limited and localized knowledge, and that all humans are roughly equal in their abilities to develop skills and knowledge requisite to their ends, led him to conclude that third parties, including the state, need to do little for people other than give them the opportunity to act according to their own lights and to take responsibility for the consequences, positive or negative, of their actions. People's natural desires for mutual sympathy of sentiments and to better their own conditions will largely take care of the rest. So how should we categorize Smith? Smith's government is certainly not non-existent, but by modern standards, it's quite small. It leaves to individuals rather than to centralized authorities both the freedom and the responsibility to direct their own lives. It recommends following one's community's long-standing traditions as a robust but not absolute default. And it recommends its limited political institutions because they are the only ones, he thinks, under which people can develop virtue. So I would call Smith a skeptical and empirical decentralist in the tradition of classical, not progressive, liberalism. That's a mouthful. Maybe we should come up with a shorter term. And one can see why both Friedrich Hayek and Edmund Burke were devotees of Smith. But in the end, Smith's project was a serious and open-ended investigation into the moral, economic, political, and cultural institutions that lead to human prosperity and deep human flourishing or well-being. He called himself, as Phil mentioned at the outset, he called himself a moral philosopher. That seems to me about right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim. We're going to continue our progression in historical order, moving to Edmund Burke now. Our next speaker is Dr. Steve Ely, who is a senior fellow at the Liberty Fund. Before joining Liberty Fund in 1993, he was also a professor of government at Armstrong State University. He serves on the board of visitors of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy and is a contributing editor of Conversations on Philanthropy and a member of the advisory editorial board for Society. He has written on politics and the fiction of Robert Penwarren, Ralph Ellison, and Fyodor Dostoevsky, as well as on the history and intellectual foundations of American philanthropy and on the constitutional interpretation. Currently, he is working on a comparative study of stories common to the Torah and the Quran. Dr. Ely has worked on over 300 Liberty Fund conferences in the past 20 years, and while the subject matter of these conferences varies in range from the opera Don Carlos to the economic and social writing of Nobel laureate economist F.A. Hayek, Dr. Ely has organized conferences dealing with the concept of divine revelation, including Liberty Fund's first conference in which all of the conference readings were taken for the Quran. But today we're going to turn to another direction of his work, and that is Edmund Burke, and specifically positing the multiple extensions and contested legacies of Edmund Burke's work and political philosophy. So with that, I'll turn it over to Steve Ely.
Fellow members and guests of the Philadelphia Society, the first of many references to Edmund Burke in Robert Nisbet's Prejudice as a Philosophical Dictionary occurs in Nisbet's very first entry, Abortion, where he offers a brief history both of abortion practices and of philosophical and theological perspectives from the Hebrews and ancient Greeks to the contemporary preoccupation with abortion. Eventually, Nisbet arrives at Roe v. Wade and its aftermath. After surveying the ongoing battles between militant abortionists and aggressive anti-abortionists, Nisbet concludes, "Rarely has sheer zeal overtaken a moral question in the measure that is found on both sides of the abortion question. What is badly needed at this juncture is a liberal infusion of expediency in Edmund Burke's noble sense of that word." While abortion was not an issue that dominated debate in Burke's House of Commons, his public career was marked by controversies as divisive then as abortion is now. Nisbet's invocation of Burke suggests that what we might learn from him has more to do with his general understanding of the aims and limits of political power than it does with specific policy proposals or outcomes. Nisbet's adjective, noble, further suggests that Burke's expediency is more than simply politics as usual and points toward prudence as the primary political virtue. The heart of Burkean expediency, which Nisbet contrasts with coercive law, is its respectful recognition of the powerful and necessary role of human existence of privacy, use and want, tradition and practicality, not to forget larger and long-range consequences. Burke argued that very plausible schemes with very pleasing commencements have often shameful and lamentable conclusions. He added, "Is then no improvement to be brought into society? Undoubtedly, but not by compulsion, but by encouragement, by countenance, favor, privileges, which are powerful and lawful instruments. The coercive authority of the state is limited to what is necessary for its citizens." This view of Burke is contestable, of course, and there are some commentators on Burke who may seek substantive policy guidance from him. The aim of my presentation is to illustrate the range of different interpretations of Burke that are found among American conservatives following World War II, when the contemporary conservative movement was starting to take form. This presentation will not be comprehensive. I was hard at work on this paper in January when I got an email from the Society's distinguished executive director telling me that I would have 20 minutes. And so with trepidation, I took my huge manuscript and approached her and said, "More, please." And you will be happy to know that I was no more successful than poor Oliver Twist was. So in the next 20 minutes, I hope to at least highlight the essence of six approaches to Burke. One. Russell Kirk wrote so extensively on Burke that there is no way to adequately summarize him here. So I will limit my remarks to the conservative mind. First, two preliminary comments. Whether or not Kirk provides the most accurate or authoritative account of Burke, I think he clearly is the heir of Burke's rhetorical throne. among post-war conservatives. Second, I think that a more accurate title for the conservative mind would have been the Burkean mind. For as Kirk himself readily admits, the volume was confined to British and American thinkers who have stood by tradition and old establishments, and is an analysis of thinkers in the line of Burke. Kirk, convinced that Burke's is the true school of conservative principle, excluded from consideration many who might identify themselves as conservative. The question of whether the influence of the conservative mind has unduly narrowed or misdirected efforts to understand the origins and nature of American conservatism is certainly worth exploring, but is beyond the scope of my remarks, except as raised by other authors I discuss. For Kirk, there is no division between a young liberal Burke and an older conservative Burke, for there is a steady, continuous development in Burke's ideas from the earliest to the latest of the crises he was involved in. What did Burke seek to conserve? He stood resolutely for preservation of the British Constitution with its traditional division of powers as a system most friendly to liberty and order to be discerned in all Europe. But Burke was not simply a parochial defending merely national institutions for merely nationalistic reasons. A moral order, good old prescription, cautious reform, writes Kirk, these are elements not merely English but of general application. The intellectual system of Burke then is not simply guarding British political institutions. Beyond the British Constitution, Burke stood for preservation of the larger constitution of civilization. Kirk enumerates the chief articles of this universal constitution: reverence for the divine origin of social disposition, reliance upon tradition and prejudice for public and private guidance, conviction that men are equal in the sight of God, but equal only so, devotion to personal freedom and private property, opposition to doctrinaire alteration. On a panel entitled "The Liberal Origins of Conservative Thought," it is incumbent to emphasize an aspect of Burke that Kirk recognizes. No one better apprehended the arguments for reform, but reform, said Burke, needs a delicate touch. Kirk's account of Burkean reform led him to conclude that Burke was always a liberal, but never a Democrat. It is important to note that Kirk writes of both small L liberals, who may simultaneously be reformers and conservers, and capital L liberals, committed to an decidedly un-Burkean political ideology of radical innovation. Kirk provides a taste of Burkean liberalism when he turns to the liberal conservatives Macaulay, James Fenimore Cooper, and Tocqueville. Kirk writes, "We are in danger of forgetting how strongly attached the old liberals were to liberty. Political liberalism was conservatism of a sort. It intended to conserve liberty." I take the lessons these three learn from Burke to be the heart of Burke's liberalism: a tenderness for private property and a suspicion of any political power not grounded upon a propertied interest. He reminded them that a people is not simply an aggregation of persons told by its head. Burke's misgivings as to government was nearly so marked as his veneration of the state, and the liberals inherited his ideal of a government which governs so little as it prudently can, which rarely invokes its reserved powers. The foregoing raises two questions. First, what's the relationship between small L and capital L liberalism? Is the latter, to use a term from Eric Voegelin, a deformation of the former, the hardening of a living reality into an ideology? Second, is there a similar distinction between small C and capital C conservatives that needs to be made? Is it possible to go no further than our current text that Kirk's canons of conservative thought have for some ossified into the canons of conservatism, heavy artillery designed to blow one's opponents away in an ideological war? Kirk situates the foundation of Burke's thought in Christianity. Revelation, reason, and an assurance beyond the senses tell us that the author of our being exists and that he is omniscient. The man and the state are creations of God's beneficence. This Christian orthodoxy is the kernel of Burke's philosophy. Here are, in bullet point fashion, a few of the implications that Kirk draws from his discussion of Burke's orthodox foundation. Every state is a creation of providence, whether or not its religion is Christianity. Burke states that a universal equality among men exists, but it is the equality of Christianity, moral equality, or more precisely, equality in the ultimate judgment of God. Burke believed that the church must be interwoven with the fabric, within the fabric of the nation. Burke praises two great virtues, the key to private contentment and public peace. They are prudence and humility, the first preeminently an attainment of classical philosophy, the second preeminently a triumph of Christian discipline. Tradition and prescription are the guiding lights of the civil social man, and therefore Burke elevates to the dignity of social principles those conventions and customs which, before the 18th century, most men accepted with an unreflecting confidence. Kirk sums up Burke's natural law teaching as follows, and I should mention a longtime distinguished member of the society, Peter Stanlis, who agreed with Kirk on Burke's natural law foundations. The true natural rights of men, then, are equal justice, security of labor and property, the amenities of civilized institutions, and the benefits of orderly society. For these purposes, God ordained the state, and history demonstrates that there are the rights desired by the true natural man. Two, while Kirk was perhaps the most influential conservative promoter of Burke in the post-war years, he was not the first. Francis Graham Wilson featured discussions of Burke in a number of articles published during the war and in The Case for Conservatism, published in 1951. According to Wilson, Burke was trying to say that while we must live with history, while we cannot escape its impact upon us, we can also live there with enthusiasm and with loyalty to the historical community of which we are a part. Wilson maintained that Burke's system was a defense of the national tradition and of the nation-state as the context for the good life. That is to say, Wilson understands Burke's universal argument for tradition and the nation-state to have particularistic and diverse implications for how different peoples should live their lives. The lesson Burke taught, writes Wilson, is that while there was a pattern in history, each nation had to learn its own lesson from its own national tradition. Wilson explicitly contrasts Burkean and American conservatism. While Burke appealed both to the established principles of the British Constitution and to the principles of sound government, our leaders could appeal only to the principles of society on which they believed a just system might exist. In Wilson's opinion, the Federalist Papers rank with the writings of Burke in the creation of the modern conservative spirit in politics. Wilson's sense of American conservatism is best captured in this passage. Conservative spirit in America is never simply a defense of things as they are, for at the height it seems to blend the fading past and the emerging future into an imaginative presence. While it can never do is relieve men of their responsibility in the vast context of experience. Three. While Francis Graham Wilson sees Burke and the Federalist Papers as co-equal foundations of American conservatism, one of his students, Wilmore Kendall, was not as forbearing as was Wilson. Kendall pushes Wilson's insight into the Federalist Papers further than Wilson did. In the posthumously published The Benevolent Sage of Macosta, Kendall takes direct aim at Kirk's claim that Burke is the father of American conservatism, writes Kendall. And Kendall always writes in the mouthfuls. So, hold on. If we were to assume that conservatism equals adherence to the old and tried, equals opposition to change, then we must look askance at the contention that both Burke and the founders of the American Republic were conservatives. For even if we grant that the American Revolution was on one side a conservative reaction against innovation by that wicked fellow George III, the feat of fitting the founding fathers into the category of opponents of change and adherents of the old and tried is one that, quite simply, no one, not even someone with Russell Kirk's gifted pen, is going to bring off because it cannot be done. Change, and not slow change either, was the watchword on these shores from the moment of the Mayflower Compact, which in and of itself was a breathtaking political innovation. As in due course, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States were also to be innovations. I know that all that was done in accordance with the traditional rights of Englishmen. But after you have milked all that dry, you are still up against the fact that principled general opposition to change, political, social, economic, what have you, was not characteristic of our founding fathers, was never in American conditions, and is not today a possible political posture, save perhaps as we confine our purview to the ancient moral traditions of mankind, and only if you can work all men are created equal into your picture of those ancient moral traditions. Put otherwise, take Burke as your Bible for this purpose. Take as your premise that what Burke taught is conservatism, and you will indeed find yourself with passages on your hand that point you to adherence to the old and tried as the essence of conservatism. But take the Federalist as your Bible, and you will find few such passages and very guarded ones when you do find them. Take a breath. Four. Leo Strauss's account of Edmund Burke is of a valiant effort gone awry. Burke attempted a last-minute return to the pre-modern conception of natural right. At one level, perhaps, Burke was successful in this venture, for his conservatism is in full agreement with classical thought. At a deeper level, however, Burke's career is marked by a tragic paradox. It's my term, not Strauss's. For while Burke's conservatism was in agreement with classical thought, Burke's interpretation of his conservatism prepared an approach to human affairs which, in Strauss's view, is even more foreign to classical thought than the very radicalism of the theorists of the French Revolution. In opposing the radical French intrusion of the spirit of speculation or of theory into the field of practice of politics, Burke seems to return to Aristotle's practical political science. However, Burke is not content with defending practical wisdom against the encroachments of theoretical science. He parts company with the Aristotelian tradition by disparaging theory and especially metaphysics. After a comparison of classical and Burkean views of constitution making, Strauss offers this summary conclusion. Classical political philosophy was the quest for civil society as it ought to be, the best regime without qualifications. But Burke's political theory is, or tends to become, identical with a theory of the British Constitution. By favoring historical jurisprudence over metaphysical jurisprudence, however, Burke paves the way for the historical school. And this is the tipping point for Strauss that converts conservative Burke into the most radical opponent of classical philosophy. Rather than judging the wisdom of the British Constitution solely by virtue of its adherence to transcendent standards, Burke affirms, "Our Constitution is a prescriptive constitution. It is a constitution whose sole authority is that it has existed time out of mind." Burke wanted to establish political principles on historical foundations, but the search for standards grounded in the particulars of history ignores the possibility that particular or historical standards can become authoritative only on the basis of a universal principle which imposes an obligation to accept them. For Strauss, therefore, the historical school inevitably slides into historicism, which for Strauss is a particularly virulent form of relativism. Five. Richard Weaver's primary treatment of Burke is found in The Ethics of Rhetoric and offers an analysis of Burke's representative style of argument. "The true conservative," writes Weaver, "is one who sees the universe as a paradigm of essences of which the phenomenology of the world is in continuing approximation." William Buckley, Jr. declared that was the best one-sentence definition of a conservative he knew of. Following this line of argument, Weaver maintains that those who prefer the argument from definition are conservatives in the legitimate sense of the word. While Weaver recognizes that Burke is widely respected as a conservative who was intelligent enough to provide solid philosophical foundations for his conservatism, he concludes that Burke had a strong addiction to the argument from circumstance, and he further maintains that this is the argument fatal to conservatism. This is crucial for Weaver, for he believes that a man's method of argument is a truer index of his beliefs than his explicit profession of principles. Weaver documents Burke's addiction to the argument from circumstance in three representative controversies from Burke's career: the Catholic question, the American Revolution, and the French Revolution. Weaver's final judgment is that Burke's primary reliance on the argument from circumstance undermines his explicit invocation of natural law, leads to short-sightedness, a mindless opposition to incumbency, and the unintentional courting of failure. While Burke left many wonderful materials which political conservatives should assimilate, these were always auxiliary rhetorical appeals. Weaver concludes that Burke was magnificent at embellishment, but of clear rational principle, he had a moral distrust, and therefore Burke should not be taken as a prophet by conservatives. Six, Edmund Burke enters the Constitution of Liberty as a member of the English team in Friedrich Hayek's comparison of the English and French traditions of liberty. The English approach to liberty is captured in Adam Ferguson's observation that nations stumble upon establishments which are indeed the result of human action, but are not the execution of human design. For Hayek, the greatest difference between the two views, English and French, is their respective ideas about the role of traditions and the value of all the other products of unconscious growth proceeding throughout the ages. Rationalists who believe that all useful institutions are deliberate contrivances and who cannot conceive of anything serving a human purpose that has not been consciously designed are almost of necessity enemies of freedom. What the English team sees as freedom appears to the French team as merely chaos. For those open to accidental and evolutionary developments, however, the value of freedom consists mainly in the opportunity it provides for the growth of the undesigned, and the beneficial functioning of a free society rests largely on the existence of such freely grown institutions. After noting the importance of a genuine reverence for grown institutions, for customs and habits, Hayek concludes, paradoxical as it may appear, it is probably true that a successful free society will always, in large measure, be a tradition-bound society. Burke also plays a role in Hayek's postscript of the Constitution of Liberty, Why I Am Not a Conservative. Hayek begins by noting the contemporary confusion in the meaning of liberal, liberalism, and conservative, made worse by the recent attempts to transplant to America the European style of conservatism, which, being alien to the American tradition, has acquired a somewhat odd character. His decisive objection to conservatism is that by its very nature, it cannot offer an alternative to the direction in which we are moving. Conservatives may serve as a brake on the vehicle of progress, but cannot move society toward a new objective. The true conservatives of Europe, Hayek argues, did show an understanding of the meaning of spontaneously grown institutions such as language, law, morals, and conventions. But the admiration of the conservatives for free growth generally applies only to the past. Hayek, however, does not include Burke among the true conservatives. Rather, he accepts Lord Acton's account of Burke, Macaulay, and Gladstone as the three greatest liberals. In part, Hayek's lecture is a search for the appropriate name for the Party of Liberty. Nearing the end of this lecture, Hayek almost sighs. What I should want is a word which describes the party of life, the party that favors free growth and spontaneous evolution. Earlier, he had written, Edmund Burke remained an old Whig to the end and would have shuddered at the thought of being regarded as a Tory. As Hayek concludes his search, he states, the more I learn about the evolution of ideas, the more I become aware that I am simply an unrepentant old Whig, with a stress on the old. So the structure of my remarks thus far reminds me of one of my favorite childhood TV shows, To Tell the Truth, in which three contenders claimed to be the same person, and the panel of judges was supposed to, by asking questions, choose who was who. So let me very quickly summarize our six contenders. Russell Kirk's Burke is primarily a defender of good old prescription and the intellectual founder of conservatism on both sides of the Atlantic. Francis Graham Wilson recognized both Burke and the Federalist as foundational for the modern conservative spirit and emphasizes Burke's pluralism in recognizing a variety of national traditions. Wilmore Kendall rejects Burke, defender of Crown and Church, as foundational for an authentic American conservatism. For both Leo Strauss and Richard Weaver, Burke's mode of argument undercuts the explicit principles he articulates. And finally, Friedrich Hayek embraces Burke as a fellow old Whig, a member of the Party of Life, the party that favors free growth and spontaneous evolution. If this were an episode of To Tell the Truth, it would conclude with the host saying, will the real Edmund Burke stand up? And I am out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. And who'd have known that in the course of an hour we've gone from one Edmund Burke to two Edmund Burkes to six Edmund Burkes. He's quite the multiplicative personality, and I think we're thankful for that. Turn to our next historical progression. We're going to jump the channel, move over to France. Our next speaker is Dr. David Hart, who is the man also responsible for putting all the great works of our three figures of consideration online. He's the director of Liberty Fund's Online Library of Liberty Project. I urge you to check that out. I read it almost daily. He has degrees in history from Stanford University and King's College, Cambridge, and taught for 15 years at the Department of History at the University of Adelaide before joining Liberty Fund. David is also best known, perhaps, as the editor of the collected works of Frederick Bastiat, who will be the focus of his remarks. With that, I'll turn it over to David Hart.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. This is my first time attending a Philadelphia Society meeting, and I'm looking forward to lots of interesting discussions with you. The title of my talk is Bastiat and the French Connection, and it's a deliberate reference to the wonderful Academy Award-winning film The French Connection, made in 1971, starring Fernando Rey and Gene Hackman and Roy Scheider. And it's a story about drug trafficking from Marseille to New York by hiding cocaine in someone's car that they don't know about. And what I want to talk about today is another kind of trafficking, and this is trafficking in ideas. And in many cases, the ideas that were being trafficked for the classical liberal movement are far more dangerous than heroin or cocaine. Just ask the Politburo of the old Soviet Union. What I want to do is to talk about the quite complex trafficking in ideas that went back and forth across the Atlantic from both America and France and back again over the last 250 years. This has been a two-way process, and the interaction is something that I find fascinating. The first examples of this trafficking is between France and America. France is the central location of the Enlightenment. Many of the American intellectuals in the pre-revolutionary period were voracious readers of French books and other Enlightened texts. Donald Lutz has done a very interesting study of the contents of libraries in colonial North America and has come up with a kind of top 40, which were texts which were common, you know, throughout the colonies in both private and public libraries. And of these top 40, eight of them were French books that were not translated into English. This is quite interesting that so many American intellectuals read French, particularly Thomas Jefferson. If you go to his library displayed in the Library of Congress, they've got a beautiful new section now where Jefferson's library is in the shape of a circle and the cases are enclosed in glass, and you can walk behind them or in front of them. And so many of the books on his shelves are in French or Italian. So he was multilingual in his interests. So there's and Lutz's study of American library and purchasing habits is very interesting. I suggest you look at that. Another example of the interchange of ideas in the first part of the late 18th century and early 19th century is, of course, the number of American statesmen and politicians who went to live in France to work on American business. And a good example of this is Benjamin Franklin, who was the U.S. minister in France from 1778 to 1785. And I'm so pleased that the hotel administration put up a picture of Benjamin Franklin outside this lecture as a kind of teaching aid for this talk. But Benjamin Franklin is a very interesting example because he's one of the first instances of the reverse traffic. The French were fascinated by Benjamin Franklin, and when he was minister in Paris, he dressed as the French thought that most Americans looked like, you know, with his fur hat and his rough-spun coat, espousing the virtues of the American frontiersman. But being the entrepreneur that he was, Benjamin Franklin had his Poor Richard's Almanac translated into French to coincide with his period in France, which became a bestseller and just perpetuated this image of American folk knowledge and ideas about self-help and so on. There are other examples I could talk about, like Jefferson and Gouverneur Morris and Thomas Paine and John Adams, who lived in France and absorbed both French ideas but also told the French about the experiment in democracy and in republicanism that was going on in America. Another interesting example of French to America trafficking in ideas is Thomas Jefferson. Now, as a retirement activity, Thomas Jefferson decided to translate the works of D'Estude de Tracy, who was a leading French economist and political figure in the 1790s. And Jefferson was so taken with his ideas that he translated two of D'Estude de Tracy's works, one a series of commentaries on Montesquieu and one a treatise on economics. And he was so impressed with this that he wanted to make D'Estude de Tracy's two books the foundation reading for the new University of Virginia that he was involved in establishing, which is very interesting, I think. Another example of the French to American transmission of ideas is the translation of the economist Jean-Baptiste Say's treatise into English. There was an English edition, it was an English translator by the name of Prinsep, but there was an American edition as well, which was edited by Biddle, who happened to be a Philadelphian. He served in the voluntary militia here in Philadelphia in the 1810s, and he introduced a whole series of editorial matter into the book, and it went through 14 editions in the early 19th century. And Jean-Baptiste Say's treatise became the primary textbook for the teaching of economics in American colleges up until the Civil War, when people like John Stuart Mill's textbooks replaced the more radical free trader Say as the elementary textbook for American students. Another example that I want to spend more time today talking about is Frederick Bastiat, who was writing in the 1840s. So we have this first phase of French ideas influencing America, which is D'Estude de Tracy and Jean-Baptiste Say, and then Frederick Bastiat is the third one. And he's writing at a time of the French Revolution of 1848, when the French, for the first time, are trying to create a welfare state in the first few months of the revolution after 1848. And Bastiat is one of the leading figures in opposing the introduction of government-subsidized and paid-for unemployment, the National Workshop Scheme. His books were immediately translated into English, including an American English version, which sells quite well in the United States in the 1840s and 50s. And Bastiat's ideas are not, many of his more theoretical ideas are not translated into English quickly, but American economists who read French adopted many of his ideas about the nature of exchange, the nature of the provision of services in a voluntary fashion being a sort of central core to what the free market is all about. His ideas were taken up by professors of economics here in the United States, people like Perry and also the sociologist William Graham Sumner, who taught at places like Yale, which is hard to imagine today being hotbeds of free market economic thinking. Unfortunately, Bastiat's ideas become less and less favourable or favoured in America as the 19th century wears on. And it's not until the 1930s, when there's a rediscovery of Bastiat's economic theories, that we see a real impact on American conservative thinking. And that's what I want to talk about more in detail today. If you want to read about the 19th century French and American exchange of ideas, please have a look at this paper, which is on the web, and I'm sure Lenore will have the URL that she can make it available to you if you request it. But I want to look at the renaissance of Bastiat in post-World War II America. Now, it's a tragedy that he disappeared from sight, not just in America, but also in France, in his native France in the 19th century. As the century wore on, his ideas about free trade and limited government dropped out of favour. But the rediscovery of Bastiat occurred first in America, not in France, which is very interesting in its own right. It began with the journalist, the publisher, Raymond Cyrus Hoyles, R.C. Hoyles, who was a publisher in Ohio, decided to move to California to set up what became a whole chain of newspapers. He began with the Santa Ana Register, but his Freedom newspapers, Freedom Press, was quite influential, and he was one of the leading figures in the struggle against the New Deal. And he would write his daily editorial comments that would get published and syndicated across all these other newspapers. I don't know how, but somehow Hoyles discovered the writings of Bastiat in a late 19th century translation, and he decided to republish Bastiat using his own printing presses for the Santa Ana Register. And that's how American conservatives came to know about the radical free market ideas about Frederick Bastiat. And what he did was he would write new introductions to these older 19th century translations, where he would show the relevance of Bastiat to the struggle against the New Deal. And here's an example of one of the introductions. He said, "The new forward to what is now called social fallacies by the libertarian journalist was the writer Rose Wilder Lane." And this is what she said in this introduction to this new edition. She said, "Frederick Bastiat is one of the leaders of the revolution whose work and fame, like Aristotle's, belongs to the ages. Aristotle, too, was a pioneer in an unexplored continent of human knowledge. He did little more than blaze two or three trees where the wilderness road began. He showed the way to a new world that he did not reach. What modern science owes to Aristotle, a free world will someday owe to Bastiat." And he made the connection between Bastiat and the New Deal even more explicit when Hoyles himself, in a new introduction to one of Bastiat's books, he said, "The reason for republishing Bastiat's economic sophisms is that we believe Bastiat shows the fallacy of government planning better than any other writer of any period. Since he wrote a century ago, his work cannot be regarded as party politics today. It deals with fundamental principles of political economy which outlast all parties." Working with R.C. Hoyles in California at that time was Leonard Reed. He was the head of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce, and that is how he became interested, I think, in a more radical version of free market economics, working for Hoyles. Reed decided to move to New York, to the New York area, to set up the Foundation for Economic Education. And inspired by Hoyles and his reading of Bastiat, Reed decided to introduce to begin a large publishing and translating project to bring more of Bastiat's writings to the knowledge of Americans. So in the 1950s and 60s, he began a project which ended up with the translation of what we now know about Bastiat, his selected essays on political economy, an essay, The Law, the Economic Harmonies, which was done in a new translation, which are very, very fine. Well, one of the other things that brought Bastiat's ideas to the attention of Americans at this time was the journalist Henry Hazlitt, who was writing for the Wall Street Journal. And he was one of the few voices speaking out in favor of free markets at the time. And he, in turn, wrote his own popularization of economic ideas called Economics in One Lesson, which is actually a plagiarism. He took it from the subtitle of Frederick Bastiat's essay on the seen and the unseen. So Henry Hazlitt was another figure who was reintroducing free market ideas into the American conservative movement. Another person who's very important is Ludwig von Mises. When he fled Europe and moved to New York City, he got a job at NYU. He wasn't paid a salary by NYU, but various business people put money together to pay him a salary, and he ran a seminar which became extremely influential in the revival of Austrian economics in the second half of the 20th century here in America. And he spoke very favorably about Bastiat, and some of his more radical students at the time attending his seminar set up their own Bastiat circle. And the people who were involved in this circle is sort of like a who's who of important post-World War II libertarian and classical liberal thinkers, Murray Rothbard, Leonard Digiow, Ralph Rako, and others. And these were young men, freshly minted PhDs or graduate students, who adopted the name Bastiat as the name of their society to promote and discuss free market ideas. And another person who's very interesting at this time is Ronald Reagan. Now, his case is a little bit more difficult because no one yet has done a thorough study of his note cards. In his presidential library, there are hundreds and hundreds of these note cards where Ronald Reagan would write down interesting quotes that he would use in his speeches. And this is something that is just crying out for a graduate student to look at, and I would strongly recommend that to you if there are any of you looking here looking for a topic. Let me just say something briefly about Ronald Reagan's connection with Frederick Bastiat. is that it's quite possible that Reagan had read some of the publications of R.C. Hoyle's or Leonard Reed in the 50s, and this is one way in which he may have come across the ideas of Frederick Bastiat. I don't think Ronald Reagan read French, so it must be through the English translations. But when he was working for General Electric, he was their public spokesman. And one of the things he had to do as their traveling ambassador was to go around the country talking to the thousands of General Electric factories and their workforce to tell them about the ideas that the management of General Electric were interested in pursuing. And Thomas Evans has written a book called The Education of Ronald Reagan, which appeared in 2006, where he describes Reagan's evolution from a a typical Hollywood liberal in the American sense to the kind of Ronald Reagan that we now associate or think about. He says, this is Evans, he says, "I trace Reagan's revolution from liberal to conservative, from actor to politician. The changes took place during the time when he served as host of the General Electric Theatre on television. His contract also called for him to spend a quarter of his 8 years, 1954 and 1962, with the company touring the 40 states in 139 plants of GE's far-flung decentralised corporate domain. Reagan learned more in his GE years than a set of prepared remarks. He became familiar with such diverse thinkers as Mises, Lenin, Hayek, the Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu, Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, Henry Hazlitt, and Bastiat." And in an interview with Manuel Klausner in Reason magazine in 1975, he explicitly mentioned his debt to Frederick Bastiat. So if a PhD student, the study of how Reagan came to know about Frederick Bastiat and other classical free market economists is a wonderful dissertation topic. Since the wonderful pioneering efforts of the Foundation for Economic Education in the 60s to bring more of Bastiat in English to the American audience, there's been a rediscovery of Bastiat sort of 40 years later. To coincide with the 200th anniversary of Bastiat's birth, Liberty Fund decided to begin publishing the complete works of Frederick Bastiat in 6 volumes, and we're now getting volume 3, so we're halfway through the project. Volume 3 is in production now. But this is having an interesting effect in the other direction. Right, it's now time for America to start re-influencing the French in their understanding of free markets. Right, this has been going back and forth repeatedly. The pendulum is now swinging in the other direction. One of the things about the French free market tradition in the 60s and 70s was that if the very few French economists who were free market had studied at Chicago and were influenced by Milton Friedman. And so free market ideas in France got the impression was that this was an Anglo-Saxon plot to overthrow and destroy the glories of the French nation. If only, yes. But with the American interest in Bastiat through the Foundation for the Economic Education and others, the French have now come to realise that they have their own domestic free market and free trade tradition, which they hadn't really known about before. And so there's this extremely exciting flurry of interest amongst French publishers and think tanks and so on to rediscover their own heritage. And this is a very promising, this kind of blowback, if you like. They planted the seeds of economic liberalism in America and now it's blowing back to hit them in the face. Hundreds of years later. For example, I was talking to the head of the Institute, the Molinari Economic Institute, headed by Cécile Philippe, and this has been going for about 10 years in Paris. And when Cécile began working on her think tank, she said that no one paid them any attention, that they didn't exist. And she said, now they're the go-to people when the French press or the French media want to talk about free market ideas. They still don't like these ideas, but they go to her to get her opinion. They used to dismiss free market ideas as saying, this is an Anglo-Saxon plot to overthrow the glory of the French state. And she can now point to them and say, no, in fact, we have a glorious free market tradition that goes back to Destutt de Tracy, Jean-Baptiste Say, Frédéric Bastiat, Gustave de Molinari, and they are even more radical and more free market than anything the Anglo-Saxons ever did, which I think is extremely amusing. What's happening is that free market ideas are now coming back to haunt the French. They're coming back from America to bite French statists where it hurts them most, in their collective or collectivist derrieres. And Frédéric Bastiat is having an important part in that process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. We'll go ahead and take questions. We've had a bit of a tour de force of 250 years of intellectual thought. Ask two things, to please state your name and also keep your comments to a question rather than a speech. So we'll start over here.
Lee Edwards, I can attest that Ronald Reagan came by his interest in Frédéric Bastiat very honestly. In 1965, in the fall, my wife Ann and I were traveling with then the Hollywood actor looking to run perhaps for governor of California. We were invited up to his home in the hills overlooking Hollywood. And we're seated looking at his library. And I walked over and began plucking out books from his library. And they included The Law by Bastiat. Not only was the book there, but it was dog-eared and was underlined by him. So this is 1965, that he had not only been picking up bits and pieces, but had read The Law. And since you mentioned Hazlitt, I'll also mention that the other book there, among others, that obviously had been dog-eared and underlined, was Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. So Ronald Reagan was a true intellectual, in my opinion.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Greg Collins, Catholic University. Can you discuss the relationship between the embrace of commercial society and virtue, because American conservatism, there's an inherent tension between sort of inculcating moral virtues while also embracing the roots of self-preservation that John Locke discussed. And because Burke and Smith, they thought about political economy in similar ways, but they also had conservative tendencies. And so were they able to work out this problem in their own thought? I'm thinking of Burke's thoughts and details on scarcity when at times he embraces free markets even more so than Smith at some point. How are they able to work this out, this question?
Other than the pamphlet that Phil mentioned earlier, Burke is involved in practical. He never writes an economic treatise. Right? So to the extent that he is, he did try to, in every area of his political life, what's interesting is seeing how he tries to balance an openness. But I have to admit, I am not an expert on Burke's economics, and I don't know whether Jim can add anything to it, but I don't really have a good answer for you.
Should I speak to it? I'll say something briefly about Smith. I think Smith, to some extent, shared Montesquieu's view that commerce could have a civilizing effect on society. And he developed that in many ways. But one interesting example of that is the effect he thought decentralizing religion would have on tempering the enthusiasm of zealots. He thought if you allowed competition among churches, what you would see is not a diminution of religion, but rather people finding the kinds of religious expressions of religious sentiment that satisfied and interested them and created genuine religious community. But you'd find fewer of them interested in killing one another, which would be a good thing, he thought. And I think he thought something similar with respect to commerce. What commerce can do is it doesn't mean that people won't have differences. They will have differences. But what a market economy can allow is a place for people with various kinds of differences. And it generates an interest in them, It generates in each of the various people who take part in a market economy an interest in preserving the existence of others. So you don't want to kill your customers. You want them to continue to be your customers. So this could have a civilizing effect, he thought.
Over here.
Yes, thank you. Michael Maybach with the board of the John Jay Institute. So this is for Philip. Philip, I think if I heard correctly, you tried to disparage Mr. Hamilton, who's buying our lunch today, as you know, right down the hall, friend of George Washington. So I want to defend him. You know, in the Federalist Papers, I think it was number 35 or thereabouts, he says, Europe is attempting to regulate us into subservience, our commerce, to be the mistress of the world. He wasn't very happy about mercantilism at all. And the founders, and I believe this might have been Franklin and others, went to Europe to try to negotiate a free trade agreement, and they even invented the term most favored nation. And when they couldn't get the European mercantilists to change their ways, then they turned to industrial policy and to protectionism and tariffs, only because they couldn't change their trade partners. So can you accept this amendment to his good character?
With a caveat, and that would be that there is some constitutional danger that emerged from it, and that is opening the door to a directly commercial policy that's managed by federal policy initiatives. What we end up doing is expanding the legislative realm into managed tariffs, into managed subsidies, and that opens up a constitutionally problematic direction I think we're still feeling some of the effects of today.
Sure.
Yes. My name is Matt Sheffield, and I have a question about, actually, he was just briefly mentioned, Montesquieu was the most cited person by the American founding fathers. Could we have a bit of discussion about the influence of his thought on the American founding?
How much time do we have, Mr. Chairman?
3 minutes. Go quickly.
His influence was enormous, and I would say it's on par with John Locke, arguably the two most influential thinkers on the founding. However, I will mention that it's often unremarked, the influence that Adam Smith had on the American founders. When Mr. Jefferson drew up a course of reading, as he called it, for young men that would pursue higher learning at what became the University of Virginia, among the books he included, and it was a very short list, but among the books he included were Locke's Second Treatise of Government and Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. He had the humility, however, I must note to his credit, he had the humility not to include his own redacted Bible, the Jefferson Bible. He didn't have the humility not to have his own redacted Bible, but that wasn't on the list. So among the readers of Adam Smith were included not just Jefferson, but also Franklin, Washington, Paine, so quite a few from the American founding. That's not to say that Montesquieu was not a tremendous influence, which he was.
Sir.
John Jameson, I want to give you a devil's advocate question on the setting up of heroes to define a position. Give you the chance to explain and defend yourselves. Russell Kirk knew that Whiggism was a leveling, rational, rancorous cast of mind that never looked out of the eye of a saint or out of a drunkard's eye. And that suggests limitations in the philosophy of Burke, and I think that Russell Kirk would bring in Samuel Johnson, for example, to amalgamate a conservative position. And then, you know, in the roots of the American mind, he brings in Sir Thomas Browne, who was a wonderful Anglican writer. The whole problem of setting up these heroes, you acknowledge that there is a range of interpretation about them. I suggest this is in the realm of rhetoric. It is also in the realm of setting up a kind of utopian golden age of our founding with thinkers that coincidentally lived in that period. I'm only being the devil's advocate.
Well, let me respond to that, because had I not run out of time, I would have suggested
he had six more versions of
What I would have suggested is that one way to think about not only Burke but other figures, historical figures, is to think of them not as Richard Weaver's term, not as prophets who are going to tell us what to do, but as exemplars who can teach us something about the way we should live our lives. Burke was a serious man engaged in serious issues who struggled, right? He didn't have all the answers, and he struggled to find balance. That's one reason I started with the quotation from Robert Nisbet's book on a topic that still divides us, abortion. How does a prudential man deal with all of the realities of that question? Seems to me that one of the things we can learn from Burke is how, when you go into very tough grounds, how you find some grounding. I mean, so the rest of my paper, which will be at line on, so I developed that argument. So I don't hold these, I treat the American founders the same way. I am not an advocate of originalism, for example. I think that they are really important. They were political actors. If we could act as well in politics as they did, we'd be in great shape. But we can't simply replicate them. We've got to, in a society of self-government, in a nation of self-government, we have got to take their example and deal with our problems. That's my conclusion. And so which of these six positions is, you know, and if I told you which one I thought, I'd just be a seventh one. The whole point of my paper, one point, is if you're interested in Burke, forget these other guys. Go read Burke. Liberty Fund has a nice four-volume edition of Burke.
Online.
And it's online. Right. I would encourage you to. So that's. I'm not trying to sidestep the question. But I'm skeptical of anybody who holds up somebody from the past as the authoritative answer to the questions we've got to address. You know.
We are unfortunately out of time, but I'd encourage you to continue the conversation. We will be reconvening for lunch at 12 o'clock sharp, and that is around the corner in the Hamilton Room. I'd like to thank our panelists again for a great discussion to kick us off.
To Burke's letter to Smith in 1759 and the review he did of the moral sentiment, and the comparison of the man of public spirit and the man of systems. Good. I'm glad you made it. Oh, I'm glad you made it. Good to meet you.
Too bad we didn't have more time.
No, I know it.
We'll cover it over again. Yeah, thank you. That was a fun panel. Yeah.
No, that was fun.
No, that's no worries.
Good to see you.
Yeah.